Hello, and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I will give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Edward Miskey. He is an actor, singer, songwriter, writer, and producer who is celebrating being 10 years cancer-free. So Edward has a lot going on in his life, and I'm happy to have him here sharing about, you know, kind of what the past 10 years have been like, before, after, all of the good things. So thank you so much, Edward. Why don't you go ahead and tell the audience more about yourself?
Oh my God, you nailed it. I am constantly busy, always in need of a vacation and a nap. I don't do all of those things simultaneously very frequently. I go through pockets of things. Mostly acting is behind me. I'm more in the writing producing space now, which I really do enjoy. It is not my day job. I love my day job. It is very 9 to 5 and it has nothing to do with what I do, which I'm so grateful for, because it funds the rest of my life, which, as you mentioned, there is a lot of. I moved to New York City in 2005. I'm about to hit 19 years here in the Big Bad Apple. She's a bitch, y'all, but I love her. It's the best abusive relationship I've ever been in. And it's been a roller coaster of moving here to be a pop star, and then that moved into wanting to be a musical theater girly, which I was fortunate enough to do for a very long time. That was my full-time job for years and years and years and years. And, then the dreams change and the needs change and, you know, you need money to live. but somewhere along the lines in there, I had cancer, which derailed everything. And somehow, without ever having any aspirations or dreams or hopes or wants to be a writer or an author, I became both of those things. My parents were not surprised at that. They were always like, oh, you were such a good writer when you were a kid and whatnot. Which, you know, my parents are going to tell me that regardless, but because they're great. But somehow a book came out of this, and that was written in, it was originally written in 2016 to 2017, after I had met someone who was newly cancer-free. At that point, I had been out for about 3 years and just lost as hell, man. Like, you know, the things that they don't prepare you for in that scenario. One of the things I talk about the most, I think, is just getting chucked back into what people think is the life you had before, and realizing that is not it, and having to figure it out. And so then connecting with this person and realizing that I was not alone in this. And this was a very common feeling where you're just chucked back in and it's like, I have no compass here. You took everything. I don't know what to do. And this long, like hours long conversation I had with this person, I was like, I need to write about this. We cannot be the only two people. And so I started looking and asking other people who had been through severe cancer diagnosis and all of that. And all of them said the same thing. So that kind of really lit a fire under my ass to write this book. And it's called Cancer, Musical Theater, and Other Chronic Illnesses, available anywhere you buy books. And it really kind of walks through the whole what is not expected, known, or talked about when you're a cancer patient and then subsequently survive it.
So because you have been in the entertainment industry and that has ebbed and flowed throughout your career, what was it first like getting diagnosed with cancer in that industry?
Oh, what a question. The entertainment industry is not forgiving at all. I didn't tell anybody. I told my closest friends and my family, and that was it, because I didn't want to be seen as like the sick kid, or like the kid who got the job because everyone knew he had cancer, or, you know, the kid who can't do the job because he got cancer. Like, there is no winning in that scenario, in my opinion, at least in the purview of the 2011-12 lens when I was going through this. And so I didn't tell anyone. I just kind of ducked out and disappeared for a year. Didn't really say anything on social media. Didn't do anything of that nature. And It was hard because I was gaining some momentum. I had finished this long run of a production of Hairspray in Reno, Nevada, which doesn't sound like momentum. But while I was out there, it was the opposite of momentum. While I was out there, I started to get calls from bigger casting houses asking me to come in for bigger shows. It was that period of time was the first time I auditioned officially, like by request for a Broadway production. And I'd never gotten that before. And so it was just very much like, oh, I have all this to go back to when I leave here, and I'm going to have this great like uptick in momentum, and people are going to start seeing me in different spaces, in the spaces I want to be in. And it was very much like, LOL, JK, GFAO, that's not right, GTFO, there we go, I don't know letters. And, you know, I got chucked into a hospital instead. So it was the biggest letdown of letdowns, not just for career purposes, but because you just kind of like have this weird out-of-body experience of seeing your entire life be flushed down the drain.
And so how did you end up in the hospital? Like, what was your process to getting to a diagnosis? Were you relatively healthy beforehand, or did you have some like major moment?
So many major moments. I was in the best shape of my life. I was 24 years old, turning 25, and I had this tiny little lump that popped up under my arm right before I left to go do Hairspray in Reno. And I saw my doctor before I left. He diagnosed it as cat scratch fever, which isn't real, and gave me antibiotics for it, and I left. And while I was out there taking these drugs, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so by the end of the 5 months that I was out there, this thing was like the size of a grapefruit growing under my arm. I couldn't really put my arm down. I had to put it back. And like, I'd have my costume taken out because it was so big, it was taking up space. And I was trying to be very careful about changing around other people because I didn't want them to see it. And when I came back from that, I just went to my doctor to be like, let's cut this bitch out of here. Like, I don't have fucking time for this. Like, let's go. I have things to do. And that turned into, we can't operate because that area is very vascular and big nerve endings are there. And if we operate, you might lose feeling in your left hand. I'm left-handed, my left arm, my whole arm. So that wasn't an option. And then they biopsied it and they were like, hey, cool. Guess what? This is really aggressive, rare non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And we don't have a whole lot of this on record. So let's dive in. Let's play around with drugs and see what happens.
So then what was the treatment process like to be able to now say that you're cancer-free?
It was a circus, very literally a circus. It started out with 4 rounds, what was supposed to be 8 rounds of chemo, but it ended up being 4 because none of it was working. I would do it, the thing would shrink down, I'd get checked out of the hospital because the chemo rounds were like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days long. That I would be inpatient living at the hospital. And it would shrink down while I was there. I'd leave the hospital. I'd go home. The chemo would wear off. The tumor would grow back. So it was like this pulsing, like in and out of this fucking thing. It was so gross. You could feel it growing. It was absolutely disgusting. And after a while of that failing, we moved to radiation. Radiation seemed to work. I didn't really like what that hospital wanted me to do as far as protocol went, what they thought next steps would be. I disagreed with it. I didn't want to do it. I didn't feel comfortable doing it. And so I kind of put my foot down and was like, I'm getting a second opinion somewhere else, which they tried hell or high water to get me to stay and not do that because I had a rare cancer. They wanted to write the medical paper about me and do the thing. Like it was such bullshit. And there was definitely a moment where I felt this switch to, well, you're not going to live, but we're going to get to write a paper about this. So we're just going to kind of like chuck you along as best we can to maybe keep you alive. And as soon as I went to the other hospital to get a second opinion, that turned on a dime. It was like, absolutely, I was in case studies there, but that was not the leading care for me. Like there was palpable like concern and care for my life, which I did not have at the previous hospital. And that, you know, that led to my stem cell transplant where I got to be my own donor. And, you know, a couple of months later, I was good to go. The whole thing, like front to back, was like 10 months.
And do you have to have any like continual checkups, or are there any concerns of it coming back or anything like that?
Well, I mean, there's always a concern of it coming back because the nature of what cancer is, you can't actually say that it's cured, unfortunately. But I'm almost, this is my 12th year. I'm coming up on 12 years in October that it'll be cancer free. And so, you know, it's looking pretty good. You know? Signs point to yes. But it was a lot. I mean, the appointments are only once a year now. I go back to like see my regular doctor who is inside of that hospital. I do it to keep everything in one place so that like if need be, my oncologist can tap in and see what's going on. I haven't actually seen her for an appointment since 2017. Cried at that appointment when she told me I was no longer going to see her. It was the most fucked up feeling in the world. Because it was like, I should be happy that I don't want to see you anymore, but she'd become such an integral part of my life that it felt like someone was breaking up with me. It's like, no, but I love you. Yeah, it was a lot. And I don't really have to go back. It is really triggering to go to like just my annual check-ins with them because it's, you know, a place where I almost died. And so being in those halls is very like, ooh, mm-mm.
And originally you wanted to, you know, hide what was happening. You weren't telling people you had cancer. And now here you are, you've written a book, but you're in a much different place. So what kind of change to say, I want to talk about what happened and I want people to know?
Yeah, now I won't shut the fuck up about it. You know, like even after the cancer thing was done, as far as like hospital and care and recovery, the early parts of recovery are concerned, I didn't want to tell anybody. Like I still posted it on Facebook and I would have conversations with people, but it wasn't like this where I would like purposely insert myself into a circumstance where I would have to talk about it. And that was the subject. And this is what we're going to dive into. I wasn't ready to do that. I didn't want to do that. And then after I decided to write the book and I got all these people flocking to me being like, oh my God, I felt the same way. Oh my God, that's exactly what it was like. I've never read anything that like really like said what I was thinking during that period of time. That just kind of made me be like, what are you doing? Talk about it. You know, and of course and not that this is a fair comparison, but I think it's similar to the sense of like the Me Too movement in 2018, where it was like all these people came forward and spoke their truth to power and it emboldened other people to do the same and take down some very powerful bad people. And not that that's the goal here, but I think it's important and valid to hold space for people who have something to say that is important because you don't know how that's going to affect and positively impact someone else in maybe a quiet journey that they're going through or like a silent suffering that they're going through. And maybe for whatever the fuck reason, someone hears me talking about this and they're like, oh my God, same, 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 same. And there's so few resources for people who are, you know, over 20 and like under 50, where you're still in like the good prime years of your life. There's not a whole lot of context for that. There's a lot of resources and literature on cancer care for children and young adults. There's a lot of literature on cancer care for elderly people, but there's a big gap in between where you are still dating, you're still sexually active, you're still interested in having a career, building a career, saving for your future, if you even feel like you have one at that point. Like there's so many things that are just not touched upon that I needed to talk about and address because they were surprising to me. Like who knew that this is what, you know, like there's a scene in my book, not to be vulgar, but there are two scenes in my book where I am caught by a nurse trying to jerk off in a hospital room in the middle of chemo. And it's the most awkward thing in the world, but I think it's necessary to talk about. The first nurse told me that it was a good thing to do because if I don't, I would end up damaging myself because things get clogged up and whatever the fuck damaged and whatnot. And then the second one was like, no, don't do that because if you have too intense of a climax, you can cause internal bleeding and you can hemorrhage. And I gave myself a hemorrhoid doing it one time. So like there's like that stuff. That is stuff that people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s don't know about and aren't told about. Because you're not viewed as a patient, you're viewed as a patient, not as a person. And when you're a person who's in their prime and you still have wants and needs and hopes and dreams, those aren't always talked about because, you know, you're an adult, you're fine, whatever.
Well, I think you kind of mentioned earlier of the expectation of just kind of reintegrating to life. You know, you had a life before cancer, therefore now just go back to it. So
yeah, just go back. Oh my God, you get to have your life back.
So that's clearly not reality. So what were some of those sticking points really like for you that you couldn't just go back to life before?
I hated everything. I was lost and I was confused and I didn't know what to do. You know, not to be cliche, but it was very much like I didn't have a compass. I didn't know which way was up. I didn't know my head from my asshole. Like there just was no path. Whereas before, there was a path. I was like, I'm going to finish the show. I'm going back to the city. I have these auditions with these great people. You know, I am coming back into the city right before the holidays. So there's going to be holiday work to be had where I can go do a holiday show somewhere, whatever. And, you know, like even coming back from Reno, like there was a plan, there was a path, there was stuff to do and a direction. And coming out of the hospital, like you're not well enough to do that, but you're not sick enough not to. And so you're just kind of in this weird, I guess I can get a survival job or a day job or something. And then you resent it. And then you're like, you know, you don't want to play the cancer card, but then you do, and you don't feel good about it. Now I play it all the time. But in the early days, I was just like, oh, I don't want to have to do that and have that conversation. It's uncomfortable. So there really is no, there's no instinct. There's no instinct of like, oh yeah, I'm going to go do this. Or, oh yeah, I want to date this person. It's like, leave me the fuck alone. There's so much chaos going in your head about what to do and who you are and where you want to go and what you want to be and who you want to surround yourself with that a lot of times, and at least I'm speaking for myself here, I defaulted back to what I knew, which was the same people, the same audition process, the same career choices. Whereas in hindsight, maybe I wouldn't have chosen those. Maybe I would have chosen differently. I don't know. But it was just easier to default and grin and bear the fact that I didn't like that I was defaulting back to what I knew than trying to figure out something else.
So it sounds like you did get back on stage after going through cancer?
Oh yeah, pretty quickly. I mean, end of 2012 is when I was like officially like dubbed, you know, you're good to go. And the following summer, I did 3 shows back to back. And then at like 2014, I had a little bit of a dry spell. End of that year, 2014 into 2016, I was back to back the whole year. So like it just, there was no time to take a break. And by the end of 2015, after I had finished, I think my 5th show for the year, I was busted. I was so burnt out that I had to step back and take a break and be like, I have to get a desk job or a day job or something where I just cannot do this for a while. And it was during that period of time that I met that guy who was newly cancer-free. I had a desk job that I could sit at and write my book when I wasn't working. And so it's just like, it was chaos and it felt bad. And there was a lot of confusion with myself. But in the end, it was like, it was just the universe putting all the pieces in place to be exactly where I was supposed to be.
So you had that opportunity to get away from high stress, focus in on writing a book in your free time. Since then, have you wanted to get back on stage at all?
I mean, I did. You know, 2016, I did a show that year. 2017, I did a show that year. 2018, I did 3 shows that year. And all the while, I was building my own show. I had a concert tour that I took around the country in 2018 and 19. Well, I guess it started in 2017. So my book was finished, and I had originally self-published it in 2017. And I took that. That was happening at the same time that my concert situation was happening. Very busy, like we talked about. but I was really kind of ashamed of the self-published version of the book because I couldn't afford a copy editor. There were mistakes in it. A lot of the changes and edits that I had made or that other friends had made didn't save on certain there were so many different manuscripts on my desk drive or on my desktop that I was just like, I don't know which is which at some point. And so when I sent it off to be published, in the self-published and printed and everything, it was the wrong one. And so like there was some stuff that was fucked up in that book. So I was very ashamed of it for a really long time. And I just kind of stepped away from it and let it sit. And I'm sure we'll get into that, but to answer your question, yeah, I got back on stage. That break was really only a couple months until I ran off and did another show that summer.
That's okay. It ebbs and flows, busy or not. So then you had this self-publishing experience that wasn't the best, but it sounds like it's been republished or potentially. Yes. So what was then that experience like to go from, I have this book, it's out here, let's make it better?
Yeah, it was just kind of like this realization where I saw that I had an opportunity to drop some money on some people that would help me get that done. Like a publicist. Never would have thought to hire a publicist. In my mind, it was like, oh, that's for famous people who have teams. No, you have a publicist to get famous, to get known, because they leverage their relationships to put you in places for higher visibility. And I had paid a copywriter and I sent it off and I got it published. And it was for my 10-year cancer anniversary, which we timed out. It dropped on my birthday. I was in Paris for my birthday and my book dropped and I was like, yeehaw. It was a great moment. But the republish is really, you know, there was a new foreword. There were additional chapters added. Everything was professionally copy edited, reformatted. New photos were added. Like, we did the works.
So then, is this something as a writer that you're going to keep writing, or is it kind of a one and done book situation?
No, actually, I have kept writing. Even during that period of time, I was writing a series for TV. I am adapting this for TV, which I literally was doing right before we hopped on here. I have another book that I also want to adapt for television that I'm kind of writing at the same time. Like, I'm writing the book and I'm working on the deck and all of that. You know, like six or seven other television ideas that I've kind of sketched out and drafted in a deck. And here we are, like something unlocked. And it was like, this is what you shall do from now on.
So what is it like transferring a book to the television screen?
Oh my God. Where do I begin? I mean, I think the hardest part where we're at right now is that I came at this thinking that it was going to be one way. I came at this thinking, like, this is what this show is going to look like. And as we have kind of collaborated with our producer and my co-producer, it's completely different. It is night and day from what I thought I was coming into this in. It's better. It is 10 times funnier. It's ridiculous, which is what I wanted. And so, you know, I think the challenge of the next portion of this for us is to kind of re-pitch out the deck and take it to market and try and sell it. And then if it doesn't sell, then we look at getting investors and funding it that way and doing it ourselves.
So that's something you're prepared to do, like go either direction. Yeah. Basically, you're like, I want this out here.
Yeah, it's getting made one way or another. It's just a question of how. And luckily, I live in New York City, so it's possible.
And how is it that you juggle all these different passions and projects and not, you know, kind of let something fall through or make sure like you're focusing your energy where it needs to be so you're not hitting that burnout that you've hit before?
I mean, I certainly have hit that burnout that I've hit before. I think for me at least, it is a matter of staying organized. If I'm organized and I set myself up to win in that sense where it's like it's like organization and time management, let's put it that way. So like while I'm at my day job, which I love, if I have some downtime that I'm not doing anything or I'm waiting for something, I will hop on the cloud and I will get some writing done. I will hop onto Canva and I'll get some pitch decks done. you know, I'll write myself notes in my email and I'll send them to myself during the workday. So I'm very much like kind of pocketing in everything that I can during my workday when I don't have anything else to do. And then I come home, you know, I get home around 6 p.m. and I have a meeting with a producer. I meet with lovely people like you and do this kind of thing. And it's really just time management and organization. I live and die by my calendar. If it's not on my calendar, it doesn't exist and I don't know about it. And which is both a good and bad thing. Mm-hmm. Heaven help me if I forget someone's birthday party or something. And I'm like, I don't know. that's kind of it, you know, just time management, organization, calendar.
Right. All good things. And you made a quip early on about, you know, being so busy, you always need a vacation. Do you have times to take a vacation and have a break?
So this is going to answer a number of questions you've already asked me as well. 2022, I was on the national tour of Chicago because I wanted to go back, even though I had said, I'm done, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, that little musical theater temptress bitch was like, but come this way. And I went on that. And right before that really kind of took off, I was replaced at the last minute. And I didn't get a reason. I had no contacts. It was just like, we're replacing you and so sorry. Here's a check. And I took that check and I took myself to Europe for 3 weeks. And that was kind of the first vacation I had had maybe ever that wasn't visiting family or going somewhere for work. And it was wonderful. I'm so glad it happened. you know, the producers of that tour are not the best in a lot of ways, and I won't get into it, but you know, I took that check. I went to Europe for 3 weeks. While I was in, I did London and Paris. And while I was in Paris, my book was published. And everything that happened after that happened in a good way because I was taken out of that tour. And, you know, I think now that I've kind of swallowed that pill and have had the year that I've had with the book and am now back in corporate 9-to-5 life, I have official paid time off. I have official vacation that I have to take by the end of the year. So like in constant need of a vacation, yeah. And I know that I'm going to get one. And I can't wait.
So what's the next vacation? What's the plan?
Ooh. You know, there's a long list. There's a long list of places I want to go. Barcelona was one of the places when I was in Europe that I wanted to go to and I could have very easily gone to, but I just didn't manage my time the best and I was on vacation, so I didn't have to. I could do whatever I wanted and I just didn't get there. So that's very high on the list. Portugal, you know, Turkey, Istanbul specifically. I want to go to Croatia where my family's from. I want to see the region of Italy where my family is from. And just lots of European vacations in my future is what I'm saying.
That's what I'm hearing. Now, this 3 week trip and, you know, potential future trips, are you into solo travel or are you like taking friends? Like,
Love solo travel. Mm-hmm. Wow. Let me try that again. I love solo travel. words are hard today. Yeah, I went by myself. I almost missed my flight. I had just gotten back from my parents. I like ran away to my parents for a week, booked the flights last minute, got back to my apartment. I was like, I have to switch out my luggage. I thought my flight was at like 10. And so I didn't have to leave my apartment till 7. No. My flight was at 7. I needed to leave by 4. And it was like 3:00. And I was like running errands in the neighborhood. And I decided to check in early. And I was like, oh my God. And so I ran home, threw like dirty laundry in a bag with a couple outfits and grabbed my laptop and a couple other things and hauled ass to the airport. And I barely made it, but I made it. And it was so fun. And while I was there, I got to see so many of my friends that live in the UK. When I went to Paris, I saw a friend that I had worked on a cruise ship with 10, 12 years prior. And I ran into my friend Carla, who was with me in Harrisburg in Reno in Paris. She just happened to be there. So we buddied up and we went to the Louvre together and saw the Mona Lisa. It was so fun. I love solo travel. I think everyone should do it once in their lifetime, at least. I hope to do so much more of it.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you also have like a network of people that you can kind of connect with. You're not like fully on your own, but also there's a benefit to doing what you want to do and not being tied down to somebody else's schedule and needs as well.
Yeah, but because also, like, I'm such a history nerd, I could have spent 2 whole days at Versailles. I gave myself 5 hours because my phone was dying and it was my birthday and I wanted to go home and get cute and take myself out to dinner. And I did those things. But there was so much of it I didn't see, and I want to go back and go to the secondary and tertiary castles on the grounds. I did as much of the main castle as I could. I could barely do any of the gardens because they're enormous. But, I mean, that's what I want to do. And being with someone else might be like, I'm tired. I don't want to look at any of this anymore. It's like, shut up. You know, you don't have to do that if you're on your own. Like, it's just the best. And of course, then you meet people. Like, you meet people while you're out. I met this guy in London who was like this very tall, handsome, like half French, half Jamaican chef. And I was just like, I'm in love with you. And like, I went and saw so many shows and it was just on my own schedule. It was so good.
Well, and you just saying there that you saw so many shows, I was curious, like, because you've kind of slowly left being on stage, do you continue to go to Broadway shows and see?
Oh, absolutely.
So what is then your favorite experience in the audience and on stage? Because I feel like those are two very different things.
Two very different things. Absolutely. In a theater, I mean, I'm going to give 2 answers for this. My favorite theater experience, oh no, was seeing Cabaret in London, which has now transferred to New York. It starts previews, I think it started previews this week with Eddie Redmayne and Rankin. I can't remember her first name. I love her. That experience in London was one of the first truly immersive commercial theater experiences I'd ever had. And I got the VIP package ticket. We had like second row. I went with my friend Charlotte, who I also did a cruise ship with a long time ago. She was pregnant as all get out. And we were just like, you know, with the VIP ticket, you got 2 cocktails and a charcuterie board and some ice cream and macarons. And like, it was so fun. And the show was stunning and breathtaking. And it was just like this whole thing that was like, every single show should be like this. There's no reason why we can't have snacks in a show that are included with your ticket. Like, it was so good. The other thing is too, I saw this show. I tried to talk about this as much as possible because I'm trying to manifest like a longer run of the show. One of the last things I saw before the world shut down was this show called Oscar at the Crown. It was at this place in Brooklyn called $3 Bills. And oh my God, there's a concept album of this on Spotify. Holy shit. Immersive in the sense that like the stage moved and you needed to get out of the way. It was wonderful. So those are probably my 2 favorite like positive experiences in the audience. And my other one is I saw the sorry, I could go on about this all day.
That's okay.
I saw the final dress of Finian's Rainbow, which famously was not great and had a terribly small budget for what they were trying to do. But there were so many things that went wrong during the final dress, which it's supposed, that's what, when it's supposed to happen, that I just remember grinning like an idiot. It was around my birthday. I was with my friend Birdo, who I still am friends with to this day. And all these things just went wrong. And we were just cracking up at like something broke, something rolled on stage that wasn't supposed to, like someone forgot a line, like so then they were just saving each other's asses. And it was just such a great example of live theater saving itself from cannibalizing itself. It was so fun. On stage, it's probably a toss up between when I did Into the Woods in Nantucket, I was Cinderella's Prince. I've never had so much fun on stage. The guy that I played opposite with is the other prince. We just had a fucking ball. I love that man. We had the best time. The other one is probably when I was Julian Marsh in 42nd Street. You know, like 42nd Street was the first Broadway show I ever saw, and on Broadway. And it was a really great full circle experience. It was, I was really in my head at the beginning. And then once things started to roll, there was definitely a moment halfway through that run where I was like, you've got this, you're good at what you do. And this is a good job for you. And it was just, I think that's maybe the most fulfilled I've ever been.
And is there a role that you kind of still would love to do?
I'm very lucky that I've gotten to play most of the dream roles that I've wanted. One of them, unfortunately, was in The Tour of Chicago that I was removed from, but I guess I technically played it. But there's a show called Secret Garden with, there's a role, his name's Neville Craven. He's the brother to the main guy. Some of the most beautiful music in the musical theater canon, and I would fucking love to play that part.
And so with all of this experience that you have, how did you kind of first get to Broadway and performing, and what sort of educational background do you have to even be doing all of this?
None. I grew up in a very artsy, fartsy musical theater house. You know, my mom plays piano, my dad plays guitar. He's a singer-songwriter. They're both like dirty hippies from the 70s. And we had walls of vinyls that we would listen to that included musicals. And my grandmother and my aunt would give us musical movies, you know, like the My Fair Lady movie or Mary Poppins and like stuff like that. And we just drank it up. We just lapped it up. Me and my two sisters like lapped it up as kids. And that's really what kind of sparked the bug. And then we were doing shows as kids in school and in the community. And then when we were like early teens, we went to New York and saw 42nd Street for the first time. And that was kind of the first realization that it was like, oh, I can do this as a job. Oh, okay. Well then. And so that's kind of what made me pursue it. As far as education goes, I didn't even bother applying to college. I was like, fuck this. I hated high school. It was a terrible experience. I was a great student that was bullied into being a bad student because I was picked on for being smart. And so as a survival tactic, also as a gay person, adding to the list of survival tactics I've adapted over the years, I was like, I will not be picked on if I appear to be like everyone else. And so I just pretended I didn't care about school. And I became a DC student even after I was top of the class for years. And so not only did applying to college feel like not anything remotely close to what I wanted to do, it also had nothing to do with what I wanted out of a career, because you don't have to go to college for musical theater or being, you just don't need it. Like, if you want to go to like pay for clout and network, great. That works for a lot of people, specifically NYU. But it's not what I wanted. And so I just dipped out and moved to New York City, and I found a voice teacher I liked and an acting teacher I liked, and kind of did it that way.
What was it like moving to New York City straight out of high school?
I think because I had youth and ignorance on my side, it was a lot of fun. Looking back, it's like, bitch, how are you alive? There are very few reasons why you are living because of the circumstances you put yourself in. Because, you know, I was 18, 19 years old, and it was like, New York City, no parents, bank account, yay! Like, what in the world was I thinking? My parents didn't want me to do it, but I essentially bullied them into making me do it. It was like, you can help me, or I'm leaving, and you can't stop me, because I'm 18, and you can't do it. And that's how that went down. They have since forgiven me, thankfully. But the first summer was really hard. It was hard, and it was exciting, and it was fun. And for as hard as it was, I didn't care because I wasn't in Pennsylvania. And I was meeting new people all the time. This is pre-iPhone. This is barely flip phone days. This is like pre-flip phone. Flip phone came out while I was in New York. And, you know, it was a different time. And I somehow made it through.
Well, New York City is notoriously very expensive to live in, and you've mentioned various, you know, kind of jobs, careers, all of that. How has sustaining life in New York City been?
You find a way, you know. Of course, like in the beginning, till I got my footing, I had help from my parents. But I've had a job since I was 15 years old. I always wanted to work. I never wanted to like not have a job. I need it. It gives me a structure that I can't get anywhere else. And it was jumping from job to job, having multiple jobs. I remember 2009, I had 3 jobs that I had to be at almost every day. And I'd be at my assistant job in the morning. I would go to my doing Broadway merchandise job at night. And then the nights that I was not working on Broadway doing merchandise, I was out in Long Island doing a show. And so it was just like this hopping around nonstop. And if you look at pictures of me back then, I was skinny as shit because I was running my ass off, barely eating, and also making no money. Like all said and done, I was not making a whole lot of money. And I've always wanted to live alone. I never wanted to have roommates. I've mostly accomplished that for like 95% of the time that I've lived here, but that also comes with, you know, some concessions. And luckily I've found during the cancer years, I found an apartment situation that suited me. And my rent was very, very, very low. It was very, very manageable. And I was there for 10 years and I only just moved out like 3 years ago.
So would you go back and do anything differently?
You know, I think my knee-jerk reaction is yes, but then I look at the last couple years with this book and my current job and everything coming up, and like, sure, maybe, but all of that has kind of like snowballed, puzzle piece Tetris itself into where I'm at right now, and where I'm at right now is pretty good. Mm-hmm. So, no.
It's a good place to be in, and you know, your life has taken plenty of turns. So I think, you know, it's exciting to hear that you are excited for the future.
That's a change, isn't it? I think a lot of us tend to be nihilistic, and I'm totally guilty of this too, especially with everything that's going on in the world, like internationally, geopolitically, domestically. That it's very easy to fall into this pattern of like nothing matters, there's no future, so let's just, you know, have a party and burn it all down. And I definitely have days like that, for sure. But, you know, I think the thing that keeps us all going is the hope of a better future. And I know that sounds kind of like played out and cliche and maybe kind of stupid, but like we have to hold on to hope for a better future, because otherwise, why are we here? And I think one thing that's really helped with me with this is that I've kind of unplugged from a lot of news and politics and whatnot. Like, I'm aware of what's going on, but I don't pay hyper vigilant attention to it the way that I would have in maybe like, you know, 2015, 16, 2020, 21, 22, you know, and I've just kind of stepped away from it for self-preservation purposes, you know, like, I'm not here to be an internet social justice warrior. I have my opinions. I will vote the way that I need to hopefully protect my future. But I can't worry about it every day, because if I do, I won't get out of bed. And it's very, I used to judge my mom for being that way. And it was just like, you, how privileged of you to be able to be unplugged. And I still feel that way, but it's like, you know what? I keep as informed as I need to be. And I already know how I'm, you know, voting down the line when the time comes. We just had our primary here in New York State. And beyond that, what am I supposed to do? I have to keep myself going. And to keep myself going, sometimes you have to put your head down. And I think that there needs to be grace for people who feel the need to do that, whether they have a big platform on social media or not. Like, some of us just need to self-preserve and put our heads down so that we don't get trapped in this hole. There's no future. What's the point?
Yep. Yeah. You got to be looking out for yourself, realizing like what's going to help you thrive and survive. And, you know, having that reality check of, I do need to change kind of like the way I'm looking at news and social media. I think more and more that's becoming a realization. But as you mentioned, you know, there can be some of that feeling of like guilt and privilege to say, oh, well, I'm not, you know, it's not that you're not bothered by it. It's that you have to figure out what's best for yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, I think about it this way. The people who have real privilege, and I'm speaking specifically monetary privilege, they don't feel bad about anything because they don't have to. And they're not thinking about you. And so why should I think about them? I'm paying attention to what I need to do and what I want to do and what I know is right. And that's as far as that's going to go. And that's for mental health preservation.
It's a good spot to be in. Now, before I start to wrap things up, is there anything else you would like to share with the listeners today? An open slate.
What a question. Yeah, I know. Oh, God. I mean, I guess download Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, and have a listen to it. It's so good. It's so, so good. I've listened to it like 3 times already. And it is just a lesson in music history. And I'm baffled by a lot of it.
And by the time this episode's published, it will have been out for a little while. And it only just came out.
Like this week. Yeah,
just a few days ago. So
yeah,
it'll only go up from here.
It will only go up from here. That and also buy my book. Cancer, Musical Theater, and Other Chronic Illnesses, available anywhere you buy books.
Of course, yes. Now, before I wrap things up, I do always ask my guests a random question. So I'm hoping you have an answer for this one.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
What is your best dad joke?
Oh, God. Can it be a little dirty?
Sure.
Okay. This is a partial visual joke. So you, Sarah, will have to look at me to get this. Listener, you can put two and two together. Oh, fuck. I can't believe I'm telling you this. Okay. Now I'm hyping it up too far. Okay. What did Cinderella say when she got to the ball?
I don't know. What did she say?
That's a bad dad joke. I like it because it takes a minute to sink in for most people. Yeah.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. So, of course, if you would like to check out Edward's book, a direct link to his book on Barnes & Noble will be there in the description. If you'd like to go check it out, feel free to do that or support your local bookstore. If you'd like to follow Edward on social medias, his handle is the same. It's at Edward Meske, so we'll have some of those links in the description as well. Of course, if you'd like to connect with the podcast here, our website is in the description. It brings you to all of our past episodes, resources, and our social media. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, so feel free to follow those pages. If you would like to support the podcast monetarily, there is a link to do that as well. And if you would like to be a guest on the show and share your story, my email is in the description. That is always the best way to reach me. So thank you so much, Edward, for spending time with me today, and to my listeners for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Bye.